The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone.
Hi, Brian here, the integrated dentist for UK Health Radio. This show, I have what I regard as one of the leading medical doctors in his field for the whole of the UK. And I may say as well that I regard that over the years, we have become good friends and we have worked on projects together. So I'm honoured to introduce Nijon Eccles. Nijon.
Yes, hello, Brian.
So, Nijon, can you tell me a little bit about what motivated you to, first of all, take up a career in medicine, but then go into the areas that you now are an expert in?
That's a long story, Brian, but I'll give you the shortened version. Really, even from teenage years, I had an unusual interest in what I, let's loosely call it, lifestyle medicine, the impact of diet and nutrition on disease process. So even from that age, I think I was gearing up for some kind of career in a medical profession of some sort, let's put it that way. So I did a lot of reading, even in my teenage years, around this subject. So I found myself going to university to study pharmacology. That was my first degree at a young age, and spent 4 years doing a degree. One of those years was doing some research at in a hospital laboratory. And this sort of started to really awaken my interest in mechanisms, in medicine, of course, in pharmacology, how medicines worked. But actually, it didn't steer me very clearly in the direction of pharmaceutical medicine, because the more I learned is the more I realized that actually pharmaceutical medicines are fairly blunt tools to try and achieve something usually, which is quite specific. The body is particularly complex, and my first insight to that was in these initial studies. And one of the things that was clear to me is that how we often have become a little bit too dependent, I think, on single chemicals to try and achieve a major health objective. So that was, I think, my first major awakening into the area of medicine, on how we currently wield chemical tools to try and influence health, and how often inadequate that is, how often there are a host of side effects that accompany achieving some kind of health goal. Now, for me, even at that fairly young age, I was challenged to really wonder how we could do better than that. Now, that I ended up doing a PhD in pharmacology, which really honed my research skills. I spent 4 years doing that, looking at the mechanisms of menstrual migraine. So that was a very clinical project. But then during those research years, I had a lot of contact with medical doctors and realized that if I ever wanted to make a career in some form of clinical research, then I really needed to have a medical qualification. So straight out of PhD, I went into medical school and spent another 5 years back in the classroom learning to be and studying to be a medical doctor, and I qualified from there in 1992. So the thread that went through all of that was interest in lifestyle medicine, nutritional medicine, realizing how such blunt tools, pharmaceutical medicines are, and often don't achieve a really adequate and sufficient health objective, and then the research background. Wanted to find out how we could do better. So after I'd finished my medical school, I practiced for a while in hospital medicine. I won't bore you with all the specialities, but needless to say, I was looking for a route to practice in my main area of interest, which was, I suppose, a more holistic form of medicine, using natural molecules, which I've become interested in, to try and achieve a good endpoint without the downside. So I found myself, this is cutting a really long story short, I found myself in the Czech Republic where I met a doctor who, even to today, I still work with. He's in his 70s now, but ahead of his time back then. This was in 1998. He had running clinics in naturopathic medicine, nutritional medicine, and I, having met him, went back to the Czech Republic and spent a couple of months studying with this guy one-on-one. And this was like scales falling from the eyes experience, because whilst I had all the interest and I was looking to practice this, this guy was doing it and achieving the most amazing results across the board, different disease processes, including some serious ones like cancers. He was achieving amazing results. His patients didn't look like there were patients that they had any disease process, and he was essentially, without overstating it, I don't think he found a way of reversing disease process. So of course this was really intriguing to me. I learned from this guy, and then brought back all of that learning as a sort of a qualified doctor, PhD, back to the UK, where in 1998 I set up my first clinic. It's now called The Natural Doctor. It wasn't called that to begin with. But the essence of it is practicing a form of medicine where we achieve good end results without side effects, but using and wielding natural molecules rather than synthetic molecules.
Nigel, may I ask the name of the particular doctor that inspired you?
Sure, his name is Dr. Michael Kuchera.
Now,
Czech doctor.
Yes.
I was going to say, still practicing, still traveling maybe 27 days out of each month, still teaching other doctors and achieving remarkable results with disease processes. His main interest right now is in autism. And in fact, maybe I should say on the 28th of August, he's giving a talk in London, which your listeners may be interested in attending, and it's at the Marylebone Hotel on the, I believe it's Monday the 28th of August. Well worth listening to, ahead of his time, probably should have gotten a Nobel Prize somewhere along the way. Such is the status of this doctor's thinking.
That's great, because hopefully we could put a banner out, because I was aware that if they want to know the details, would they go to thenaturaldoctor.com or?
Yes, we've put up, I'll double check that, Brian. I believe we've put a notification on our website, which is thenaturaldoctor.org.
.org. That's yeah. great for our listeners. Yes.
And if we haven't, I'll make sure we do.
Great. Thank you. Sorry to cut across you there.
That's all right. It's okay. So I set up the Natural Doctor back in originally 1998, and since then the practice has grown and evolved. And some of the areas, for example, that I cover now and are my main interests are breast health. Particularly interested in that, how we can stem the tide of breast cancer, how we can reduce risk of that, and there are some technologies that I'm involved with that I believe help us on that course. Then I do a lot of bioidentical hormone work. These are natural forms of hormones that don't seem to have the downsides of the synthetic hormones. So not only do you get relief of menopause and andropause, but you get significant functional anti-aging benefits from those. And better aging is a main interest of mine. You can't really do that without the use of hormones. And if you can use hormones in a safe form, i.e. bioidentical hormones, then that's obviously better for the long term. So breast health, natural hormones, bioidentical hormones, better aging. And I suppose lastly, which if we have time, we'll come on to it, part of natural molecules. One of the things that my research background has led me to is always to find solutions for challenging problems. So one of the things I became interested in, this stemmed from some of the hormone work I was doing, was how we might be able to restore hair better, particularly in men. I did a lot of research in that, and then developed some natural products which we're seeing very significant results with. In fact, much more significant than the available synthetic products that are currently being doled out, mainly for men. But that's another area of exciting development. If we have time, it might be nice to just talk about it a little bit.
Oh, that does sound interesting, because I'm sure there's, as we talked about earlier, there's quite a few people out there who are follicularly challenged, which I think your expression.
But that's right, and it seems to have become more commonplace, and there are reasons for that. Part of it is environmental, not just genetic.
Yes, I mean, would you take a view as well that the overuse of plastics, which are releasing estrogenic esters, that we really don't know just how much of a problem it is in terms of both for men and women, in terms of having, you know, upsetting hormone balance?
Yeah, it's the thing is, there's a lot of uncertainties in this area of environmental toxicity. That's one of them that you mentioned, is the estrogenic compounds that have found their way into the environment from various sources. That's certainly a challenge, and there is certainly some evidence to suggest that they're having a physiological effect on species, and there's interesting research out there. But I think this is one of the problems of living in an ever-developing world where we have so many synthetic chemicals now in our environment, and a lot of them we don't know what the impact of them individually is on our health, let alone together. Are there any synergies in these toxins that amplify their effect? It's a big point that's being debated, and we don't know the answers, Brian. So it's not always possible to avoid all of these chemicals, but it is prudent have a lifestyle that arms our detoxification mechanisms so that we do remove these chemicals efficiently from our system when they get in. That's another big topic in itself, but there are ways that you can do that nutritionally without any downsides. You don't require harsh chemicals to achieve that detoxification process. Even common plant-based nutrients help us a lot along the way there.
Now, John, if we sort of look at one of your subject matters, which is in fact the natural hormone replacement, sorry if I'm using the wrong terminology, but I think one of the things I'm very, very impressed with what you do is that you use your science base so that you, it's not just a case of guesswork. So, for example, often if a lady will go via, say, a normal, call it NHS clinic for, say, menopausal problems, that it's often the case that there's no base study or follow-through which actually tells if the thing is at the right dose and the right, even the right chemicals that are used. Would you agree with this?
That's entirely right, Brian. We don't routinely do blood tests or urine tests in people to ascertain their base levels of hormones. And even worse, if we give a woman hormone replacement therapy, we don't monitor the levels thereafter. So we're just assuming that that the levels are appropriate for that woman. Now I don't believe is good medicine. I believe that, and the way we do it, the way I do it, is I have to ascertain base levels of hormones in blood or urine before we start. And then after 3 months of putting them on various bioidentical hormones, and there's another distinction I'd like to draw there in a minute, is we then retest them to see what levels we've achieved, because part of it is to not take the levels up too high, but high enough to give all the physiological anti-aging benefits as well as suppressing any symptoms. And levels that can be maintained year after year without overdoing it. It's not necessary to overdo it. You can only achieve that if you monitor a person's levels, which is not done with conventional HRT. Now, the other distinction between bioidentical hormones and conventional HRT is that the doses are individualized to the patient. So once you know the blood levels and you monitor those, you can set the dose that's appropriate for that individual, and then that person can maintain those doses over months and years, and the blood levels will stay fairly constant. Now that's important because, as I say, achieve effects without downsides, and these are powerful molecules. You don't need to have them in excessively large concentrations to for them to do their job. So by monitoring, you're able to cater to the individual, get the levels right for that individual. The other thing is, bioidentical hormones are often given not just estrogen and progesterone, which are the two main hormones in conventional HRT, albeit in synthetic forms. Bioidentical are natural forms of hormones, and also usually would include other hormones that diminish with aging, such as DHEA. Testosterone falls as quickly in women as it does in men, and is responsible for loss of muscle tone, loss of libido in women as it is in men, but is never replaced when women are given HRT. So again, with bioidenticals, it's a much broader way of restoring deficient hormones than just estrogen and progesterone.
That's fascinating, and I think a lot of our readers will significantly realize it's such an important issue in their lives that you can't just take a sort of sledgehammer approach to it.
No, and the other thing is, individuals respond differently to hormones. It's not everyone responds the same or the same to the same doses either, which is why you have to individualize it to get the best results. Anyone who's doing bioidentical hormone therapy correctly will do that, and that's the difference, is that it's usually monitored and monitored well so that we get the appropriate levels to get the best effects long term. And best effects don't just mean stopping symptoms. They mean giving you the functional anti-aging effects of the hormones, better brain function, better collagen in the skin, protecting the bones, building bone mineral density, protecting the heart. The list goes on. These are real better aging functional benefits, functional tissue benefits that you get from restoring the hormones to decent levels, to more useful levels, without going excessively.
Yes, and I suppose it's a classic holistic approach that the body wants to heal itself. So if you're just creating a better balance in a very important area of functional medicine here, that it then makes it easier for the body to reverse other problems.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are, if you look into the field of anti-aging medicine, and the, you know, I attend many of those conferences on a yearly basis. Really, the hormones are critical to achieving an anti-aging effect. Now, there's a lot of anti-aging medicine is very much based on the cosmetic side, you know, injectables, Botox, fillers, etc., making you look good from the outside. But if you want to achieve anti-aging benefits internally, yes, you can do so much with nutrition, but you can't do it as efficiently or as fast or effectively as you can with the hormones. So it's a very misunderstood and not enough research topic. How hormones aren't just about fertility; they're not just about, you know, producing offspring. They're also about maintaining tissue integrity, and it's a story that really needs to be told. I believe, and most other anti-aging doctors who are worth their salt will say that you cannot achieve the best anti-aging effects without the use of hormones, preferably in bioidentical form.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, what about if we move on to, I know, which is something that you've personally spent a lot of time developing, and that is your alternative to taking x-rays.
Yes. Okay. Can I lead into that, Brian?
With sure, one other, yes. Please do.
One other point that will lead me nicely into that area of breast health that I mentioned, and that is a lot of, just leading on from what we just said about hormones, a lot of women ask me this question. They're very concerned about the risk of breast cancer. And if they take hormones, are they not going to increase their risk of breast cancer? Well, the answer is, and we know this categorically now, with synthetic HRT, there are increased risks of breast cancer. Cancer over the course of years, and it's well established and found, and this was published in 2005 quite categorically. It's important to mention this because it leads us into the breast screening area, that if you, when you combine, when you look at estrogen on its own, the increased risk of breast cancer is very marginal over years, very marginal indeed. When you start to combine that estrogen with synthetic forms of progesterone, that's when we've noticed that the risk of breast cancer goes up significantly. It depends which synthetic progesterone it is according to how the risk elevates, but it goes up when you add these synthetic progesterones to estrogen. Now, in the same study, and it was looked at nearly 70,000 women, so not a small study who took various forms of HRT, in that same study, when women combined estrogen with natural micronized progesterone, the natural form of progesterone, there was absolutely no increased risk of breast cancer. None at all. And this is important. It should have hit the press. It should have been headline press, this, but it didn't. This was published in 2005 and actually confirmed subsequently in further studies in Europe. What we now know, you can give HRT safely, give estrogen safely, preferably in bioidentical form, but if you combine it with natural progesterone in micronized form, it negates any increased risk of breast cancer. Very important for your listeners to know that bioidentical forms of HRT, if administered correctly, do not give you the long-term increased risk of breast cancer that the synthetic hormones do. So having said that, let's talk about breast imaging, because about sort of 15 years ago, I came across a form of imaging called thermography. And I had to travel to the US to learn it, and from doctors who were doing it over there. There wasn't anyone at the time in the UK doing it. And I was so impressed with the science behind this. It's basically using infrared cameras, Brian, to detect heat coming from the body surface. Now, we've known from 1950s that that cancers can generate heat. Dr. Larson was one of the first to describe that heat coming from a breast cancer, but not from the surrounding tissue. So we've known for a while that that cancers generate heat. And the reason that they do is because they're highly metabolic, usually. So this increased metabolism generates more heat. And secondly, usually a tumor will nurture its own growth by stimulating a process we call angiogenesis, which is the development of new blood vessels to nurture tumor growth. Now, that process, that new circulation also brings more heat because blood flow brings heat. So those two processes, increased metabolism, increased vascular supply, create heat signatures. So that should enable us to detect a cancer sooner. And if you look at all the studies now in thermography, and let's focus maybe on breast thermography because that's the most studied, the studies show that you can detect more than 90% of non-palpable cancers in the breast using thermography. This was published in the 1980s by Dr. Spitalia and his colleagues. So what that means is that even if you can't feel anything in the breast, thermography was able to detect 90% of non-palpable tumors. That means tumors that could not be felt. So the more studies that have been done is the more we realize we have a tool here for much earlier detection of breast cancers than mammography. Now, what mammography is, to distinguish the two for your listeners, mammography is looking for a structural change in the breast that is big enough to see because it blocks enough X-rays to be seen. Now, in order to be big enough to do that, we now know it needs to be about a centimeter in size. Anything less, you're not going to reliably see with a mammogram. The problem with that, Brian, is that it usually takes 6 to 10 years for a tumor, a breast tumor, to reach 1 centimeter in size. So if that's when you're detecting it, arguably you're detecting it at least 5 years too late. So the difference with thermography is it's not looking for structural change. It's looking at these early heat changes that may flag an early development. So it gives us the potential to detect something sooner than it can. In other words, sooner than it is big enough to be seen on a mammogram. So that for me was very exciting. And once I started to look at all this, I realized that this tool was not out there as much as it should be. I don't think it was promoted correctly at the time by the early thermographers because they touted it as an alternative to mammography, and I think that wasn't the right way to go. It does something different from mammography. Mammography is looking for an established structural change. Thermography is looking, if you like, at a breast that is under stress, that has some, may have some early thermal changes, which could be precancerous or even cancerous, but may just represent inflammation in the breast. In other words, changes which could lead to a cancer developing if unchecked. So there's the major difference that I want to draw, is that thermography enables us to not only detect cancers earlier, but to detect a breast that may run into trouble. Now, having said all of that, and I should say that thermography now has advanced significantly from using nitrogen-cooled cameras to using highly advanced digital technology, we can detect temperature changes as low as 0.05 degrees centigrade.
Gosh.
So they're highly sensitive cameras, compact equipment, doesn't need a special room. The room just needs to be cooled. So it's a much cheaper technology than mammography. So what challenged me about this, Brian, is if you're going to detect something that early, and we now know from the studies that an abnormal thermogram represents an increased risk of breast cancer developing down the road, even if it's not an established cancer at the time, it's an increased risk of. So what do we do with a woman who has an abnormal thermogram showing she has increased risk? You send her for a mammogram or an ultrasound to see if there's anything structural, and nothing shows. There's a bit of a dilemma and a challenge there, isn't there, Brian?
Well,
here's a woman who's at risk, may have something too small to see on the structural scan. What do you do with that woman? Now, let me answer my own question. because that's the work that I've been doing for the last 15 years, is there are certain key nutrients which are very important for breast health and are often being overlooked. For example, vitamin D, iodine are two. And I probably can't go into all the detail of why those two are important. There are others as well. For example, how a woman metabolizes her estrogen. Is she producing toxic estrogens that can damage the breast? That's a simple urine test that can be used to establish if a woman is metabolizing her own estrogens or environmental estrogens to produce breast-damaging toxic estrogens. Now, there are nutritional ways of changing that. It actually represents a genetic change, which is forced by a nutrient or a group of nutrients. Call that nutrigenetics or nutrigenomics. The ability of certain nutrients to change gene expression is very important, and a really interesting part of science that is emerging in medicine is how we can change gene expression even with nutrients. So anyway, without going off track here too much, what I discovered after studying this for a few years is that when you replace certain nutrients to a woman who has an abnormal thermogram, which would include certain ones like D, iodine, and a few more, which I won't mention, when you restore those over a period of 6 months, I can effectively reverse a abnormal thermogram to normal over that period of time, 6 months, by using these key nutrients. So what that means is that you're, and I can do that in between 80% and 90% of women who have abnormal thermograms. So for me, the biggest story here is not just that you can detect a woman who's at greater risk, but you can non-invasively change that woman's risk over a period of 6 months so she becomes low risk. Now for me, that is the most exciting thing about the use of breast thermography, is it gives us the ability to act earlier, non-invasively, and change a woman's risk over a short period of time.
Well, that is really quite sort of the ultimate of what I would call preventative medicine, you know, and because, as you say, all the literature out there is catch things early because it's more treatable, but you're actually going a step beyond, which is just really, I think, quite mind-blowing.
Well, I think that's the essence of good functional medicine, Brian, and what that really means is that you're detecting things at the earliest possible time. A lot of what we do in medicine is not that, unfortunately, is we measure failing systems. You know, if bloods show show abnormalities, usually a system is failing. You know, how do we go? And that's one of the problems with medicine, is we don't detect early enough for most things. It's the same with aging medicine, is what are the markers that you can measure of aging? Well, there isn't one. But there are a group of them that you can measure. You know, you can measure inflammation in the system. You can measure even vitamin D is relevant to aging because it's naturally anti-inflammatory when it's at the right level. So if you measure certain markers in blood, they don't necessarily tell you that you have a disease. But what they can do is tell you that if left unchecked, if any imbalances are not checked or rebalanced, then over time, that's going to lead you to more degenerative change. So the essence of better aging should embrace early measurements of molecules or markers, which if imbalanced, would lead to greater degeneration over time. So by addressing those, you achieve better internal aging. And I would place the hormones in that bracket as well. So by replacing hormones when they're diminishing, what we're really achieving is better aging and better functionality in the long term. Yeah. So the point I was making is that modern medicine, we don't do enough tests which indicate early enough detection of an abnormal process or an early disease process that we can react to. We often detect too late. Mammography is a good example of that.
And the thing is that obviously mammography using X radiation has got its own risk benefits.
Correct. Now, no one is saying mammography shouldn't be used at all. In Switzerland are the first country to phase out screening mammography. They haven't abolished mammography. What they've abolished is screening mammography, which is where you call women who don't, from a normal population, to have a screen of with using mammography to see if their breasts are okay. Now, all the data does not support that does any good. In fact, now key doctors, including Professor Baum, who brought that into the UK, the screening program of mammography, has gone full circle and said, we're doing more harm than good. Exactly what the science shows is that mammography does not, for one life saved, 10 women are overtreated for cancers that would never have been a harm to them. It's leading to women being overtreated, and it's doing more harm than good. It should be phased out as a screening tool, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value as an investigative tool. So if a woman presents with a lump, then that's where mammography might be useful, because it defines the nature, or helps us define the nature of what that lump is. Does it look benign or malignant? It's useful in that scenario, but as a screening tool, it has not proved itself. And frankly, we shouldn't still be doing it. I'm not the only one saying that. The Cochrane Foundation says it. Professor Baum says it. And there are some leading figures now saying the same thing, which is that mammography has not proven to be of significant benefit as a screening tool, and therefore we should not be doing it. As you rightly point out, it's ionizing radiation. Women who are younger, it's not offered to younger women because the breast tissue is denser, and it's more difficult to see an abnormal structure in dense tissue. And also, younger women's breasts are more sensitive to ionizing radiation. So not only is it less accurate in younger women, younger breasts would be more damaged by that radiation. So it's not offered. MRI, just to contrast that, is the sort of new screening tool on the block, as it were. But we don't know how useful it is in breast screening. It has the disadvantages that, again, you could probably not see something less than 1 centimeter reliably. So it's, again, I would argue it's late detection. Is it less invasive than mammography? Perhaps. But the only group of women we see it has a role for have a significant family history of breast cancer. And for them, MRI does seem to be a useful screening, well, not screening, but a useful investigative tool. I would argue if we want to detect early, and that should be the key, then we should seriously be looking at breast thermography. And in fact, Brian, over the 15 years of doing this now, I've used various thermographic systems from different countries. And more latterly, I've actually developed my own based on all the things I've learned over the years. It's called ThermoCheck. And then the thing about this is that it's easy to use. It uses computer technology to assess the temperature data. It makes it very easy for a doctor to understand the report because it's mainly automated anyway. So I've developed this system not only for my own use in my clinic, but with a view to making it available to more doctors and to more women, not just in the UK, but we've got interest from Europe in placing systems there now. Part of my mission is to take this empowerment message of breast health out there, using the technology, using some of these key nutraceuticals that seem to reverse thermal changes. There's a big empowerment movement that needs to go out there, showing women that even if they have a risk, it can be reversed. And also, there is an early detection, non-invasive tool in breast thermography. ThermoCheck, which can be used to assist their breast health empowerment.
That's amazing. I remember many years ago having a patient sent to me because I think they must have had one of the old-fashioned full thermographs or thermographies, and I think it was in the armed forces. I don't think many other institutions could afford them, and it showed a lady who had a full body scan, and it showed a significant breast area, but it also showed that there was inflammation, stroke infection in the jawbone. which again could have been a tumour, but in fact more likely to be. What I think I was impressed with was not only the fact how it can show so many areas, but it's real-time physiology. You know, we're actually not looking at something which is just simply a picture. You're actually looking at something that's actually active, as you very, very astutely described earlier about the reasons why you get this increase in temperature.
Yeah, you're looking at physiological phenomena when you look at a thermogram, as opposed to just looking at a static structure. So that's the difference. And as you say, you know, it has a lot of potential use, Brian. You know, I've talked about breast. All of the research has been done on breast thermography. There's less research published on looking for other tumors. And until we have that research, we don't know how applicable it will be for other cancers. But there's certainly a lot of work out there looking at thermography for musculoskeletal problems, so screening the body, and we know there are certain thermal patterns that seem to be reflect certain disease processes, whether it's inflammation or other forms of musculoskeletal problems. There's quite a lot of thermographic data published on that. And as you mentioned, the jaw there, I know there are some dentists who are interested, including yourself, in the potential use of thermography to look at early signs of inflammation or infection in the jaw and the teeth. And actually, that's another very interesting and promising application that really hasn't had much information published on it yet. But it's an area that when I actually have a few moments that I would like to look into in the future.
But from what you've been saying, it seems as if, like, really all your areas of expertise and I'd call it very advanced integrated medicine is actually frankly linked, you know, meaning that it's not like a lot of specialists who just say I do this and then I leave it to somebody else to do that. You provide the full package.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the challenges, Brian, is deciding what not to do, because, you know, using basic principles, you can help most things, Brian. And that's because there are some common things that run through various diseases, oxidative stress, inflammation, mitochondrial dysfunction. I mean, so many diseases which have those three processes at their core, and in fact we now know that those things contribute to degenerative change and aging. So I guess a lot of anti-aging physicians are aware of it, that there are some common processes that lead to disease but also lead to more degenerative change. When you address those processes, guess what? Most things improve. So you're right. Sometimes it's difficult, more difficult to remain focused on your key areas, because you know you have the tools to help a lot of different processes at a physiological level.
That's really fantastic. Now, John, I'd like to sort of wrap up this session, but where can our readers get hold of you?
The best way is to go through our website, Brian, which is basically the natural doctor spelt in full, thenaturaldoctor.org, obviously www.thenaturaldoctor.org, and all of our contact details are on that site, plus more information about some of the other products and work that I'm doing.
I can see clearly.